Hey, it's Sarah, and today is Giving Tuesday, a global day of giving. And it's also the first day of ESPN's V-Week. We can all be a part of something big today by supporting cancer research, which is needed now more than ever. If you're able, give now at v.org/donate. That's v.org/donate. 100% of what you give goes directly to cancer research.
That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said. Well, that's what she said.
Welcome to That's What She Said, conversations with interesting people from the world of sports, music, comedy, and more, talking about their lives, careers, successes, and failures.
My name is Dulé Hill, and my dilemma is Mad King Don. How do we get him to sign off on this transition so that the country can move forward?
Mad King Don. I think what you meant to say was Mad Don King. And we've been trying to figure out how to deal with an angry Don King for absolute decades. Oh, you did mean. Okay, you meant Mad King Don. And getting him to sign off on this transition so the country can move forward. I am contractually prohibited from speaking directly to this problem. But what I would say in lieu of a actual solution from the commish, because this is way above the commish's pay grade, is that what I've done is to understand my own inability to affect the situation in any meaningful way. And by accepting and acknowledging that, I've removed the stress from myself to keep up with every single detail of what's going on, because I have no control or power over how it will evolve. Now, we can all have meaningful conversations with the people around us, and we can make sure that everyone is educated, and we can point out when things are going wrong. We can point to signs that might affect the future of our country and our democracy. We can certainly acknowledge and be sure that we don't allow this to be repeated down the road. But since I have absolutely no power over ballot counting or election calling or Supreme Court issues or anything relating to this, my solution on getting him to sign off is to leave it to the people in charge. And that's terrifying and stressful. But as I often say on this podcast, most things I worry about never happen anyway. Thank you, Tom Petty. So instead of presuming that the very worst possible thing might happen, I instead am presuming that democracy will right itself in time. And it feels like that's the direction we're going in. And then very soon we'll be able to I wouldn't say not ever think about, but very, very rarely and much less often think about anyone, Don King or otherwise, that might have plagued us over the last 4 years. I believe that was contractually allowed. And I'm sorry for not actually solving your problem, but none of us can solve it except for the people in charge. So just, you know, cross your fingers and hope everything works out.
The commish has spoken.
My guest this week is Dulé Hill. He's an actor best known for The West Wing, Psych, and Suits. He came upon the recommendation of good buddy James Rodé Rodriguez, who was on the pod a couple weeks ago. Go back and listen to that one if you missed it. It was a lot of fun. And it was great to have Dulé on. We talked about how he grew up with a big extended family in New Jersey, a terrifying moment during his national television debut, and his dance background in ballet and tap, and how that kind of got him into the entertainment world. Plus, his time on the West Wing, working with those other incredible actors, diversity in Hollywood being an issue way back when in his early 20s and still today, his chemistry with aforementioned co-star James Rodé Rodriguez, and what it was like to be on a cult hit like Psych, joining the cast of Suits, the Meghan Markle transition year, and more. It was a lot of fun. Hope you guys enjoy it.
That's what she said.
So James Rodé Rodriguez was on the pod a couple weeks ago, for those of you who are regular listeners. And when I asked who to have on, he said Dulé Hill. And he also said at some point in the podcast, the key to any successful project is just to be in a project with Dulé Hill, and then it's certain to succeed. So to find out the secrets of those success and why exactly James was so positive about the experience of working alongside him, we're bringing in the man himself. Also because ever since I announced that I had never seen Psych and that I was about to embark on the adventure, the Psychos have been all over the Menchies, excited for me. And so now I get the other half of the Psych duo. But before we get to all that, I want to go way back to New Jersey. Growing up with your Jamaican parents, what did they do for a living?
My father was an entrepreneur, self-employed businessman, and my mom was a teacher, well, a professor. As a professor, she was a teacher of teachers. So she taught early multi-childhood education.
Okay, fantastic. So what was your childhood home like? Was it curious and intellectual? Were you playing sports and music? What was the vibe?
It was a lot of fun. A lot of fun, but also, you know, my family's from Jamaica, so there was definitely guardrails of strictness of what you could do and not do. There wasn't a lot of back talk allowed and things like that. And then when, you know, my parents said to do something, we were expected to do it. If it had to be told more than twice, then you knew there was going to be some trouble coming. There was, you know, we were into sports. Both my brother and myself were into, you know, we played soccer. Also, we were into dance. My mom was also a ballet teacher at a dance school in East Orange, New Jersey. And that's how I got exposed to the world of dance. And I was going there really just to be around my brother and my cousins who were going there. And then at the age of 10, a show called The Tap Dance Kid came looking for kids who could sing and dance. I auditioned, and next thing I know, I was on Broadway. But that's like, dance was always a part of the world. Sports was always a part of the world. Faith was always a part of our world, going to church on Sundays. Family, because a lot of, you know, in New Jersey, my dad has like 9 brothers and sisters.
Whoa.
All emigrated from Jamaica. It's like, they don't all live in New Jersey, but still.
Yeah.
And then at the time, a lot of them did. And then my mom has 4. It was 4 of them. So it's a big family. But they would all interact and see each other on the weekends all the time. So it was a lot of family time. It was great because one side of my family was very close to the other side of my family. So we were all one big family. So it was a great dynamic for a young kid.
That is, very lucky to have that sort of built-in social net. The ballet, how long were you doing actual ballet before you found that tap was more your thing, or did you do them concurrently?
I did them concurrently. I did them, I did tap, jazz, and ballet at dance school. And I always started to lean more towards the tap side of things, especially as I got, the older I got, and I say older, 5, 6, 7, you know, because that's more of what my brother and my cousin was doing. So I was really looking to follow them.
I mean, I feel like, especially around that time too, I remember growing up, there was between Gregory Hines and then of course, Savion Glover, there was this like pop culture phenomenon of tap that I don't know if it's really out there right now the same way.
I mean, it is in a different, well, not in terms of pop culture, but it's actually spread wider than during that season where it was showing up in pop culture often. It's now more spread out throughout the world. You know, Brazil, Europe, Japan, Africa, you know, there's tap dances all over the place, far and wide. They just had, it hasn't really gotten back to that.
Yeah. That one star that ends up on the late night talk shows doing that.
Exactly.
I was reading about you doing Jerry Lewis's, muscular dystrophy telethon at 10. And they can't get your music to work. And so he just has the orchestra play something else for you to tap to. And I'm thinking in your 30s or 40s, that would be stressful as a seasoned performer. But at 10, this is probably your first big thing on television, right? Do you even remember? And can you access the emotions of like, oh, I'm just going to do this to like a song I've never heard on TV?
I still remember it. I still vividly remember it. Because I just joined the Tap Dance Kid on Broadway maybe 6 months before that. And I'd done the show on Broadway for a little bit, understudying Savion Glover. And then I left and did the lead on the national tour. And we were on our first stop on the national tour. So I wasn't even that set in the role, per se. And I get there, and it's like, yeah, this is the number you're going to do. You're going to play the music, and then you start. Okay, cool. I can do that. Mm-hmm. I can get out there and do the choreography for this song. And I do one turn, hit my pose, because the music's supposed to start right then. It doesn't. So I'm like, okay, they must have not seen. They must just clearly have missed me doing my turn. So, you know what? Here we go. Let's just do it one more time, so that all the people in the band who are a little
get that cue.
Yeah, let's go one more time. Do it again, and still nothing. I start looking back, like, what's happened here? And then when Jerry came out, you know, because I remember the overhead, the loudspeaker, something the voice of God said, "I think we have a problem, Jerry." And then he came over, and I'm like, "Yeah, this is supposed to be playing my music." And he's talking to the band leader, and he's like, "No, we don't have anything." Oh. He said, "What happens if I just like play some music?" And then, you know, you just dance. I remember taking, if you watch the video, I take a little step back. I'm like,
could I run right now? Could I make it out of here?
In my mind, I'm like, sir, are you crazy?
Like, yeah, I mean, if you've ever done anything like that, it's like all the cues that you get from the music and the moment that you know the twirl comes right after this. And this.
Exactly.
Oh, man. I'm sweating for you as a child right now, years later.
There's two things like in the wings or right off camera. Harold Nicholas of the Nicholas Brothers was in the Tap Dance Kid with me, and he had already performed, and he was in the wings watching. He and Hinton Battle were in the wings watching me. You know, so when I started to dance, I started to improv. They were there just cheering me on.
Oh, nice.
Like, yeah, Julie. And then another little side story I have about that moment. It was a Jerry Lewis telethon, and I didn't know. I'm 10 years old. I didn't know that you're supposed to wear a tuxedo. So I just brought this like leisure suit, you know, this little casual khaki suit. And I get there. And Emmanuel Lewis, he was there too, because actually that's where Emmanuel Lewis and I became friends, was from that moment. But he was there, he and his brother Chris, and they had on tuxedo. He had all these other dancers that were there, tech performers that had on tuxedos. And then Honey Coles came walking in. Honey Coles was one of the great icons of dance. He came walking in, and I was just sitting there in my leisure suit, and he was trying to decide whether he should wear like this sports coat or whether he should wear his tux. And I said, well, I mean, I had this leisure suit because nobody told me I had to wear a tuxedo. Yeah. And he said, well, you know what? Just so you won't be the only one that's dressed casual, I'm going to throw on my, my sports coat. So, you know,
that's great.
I still remember that moment. It was really, you know, he was Honey Coles. He didn't.
Yeah. Well, he didn't need to show up for anybody in anything other than what he wanted. But he also then like made you feel better about it. That's awesome.
And that kind of stayed with me. That stayed with me throughout things like moments like that stayed with me throughout my career of thinking about somebody else and how do I get beyond myself to make someone else feel welcomed and comfortable and in a place where they can perform their best.
Yeah.
That's really what that moment was about.
Really important. Well, especially on stage shows and stuff like that. So, you know, obviously from a very young age, you're a performer, but you still go on to study business finance at Seton Hall while you're acting. Was that a family decision, or at any point would you have just said, I'm just going to go straight into, you know, Hollywood stuff and not go on to college?
It's a decision I wanted. I mean, I really have always enjoyed arguing a point. I enjoy business. I enjoy contracts. I enjoy making deals. I enjoyed Monopoly growing up. So, you know, and then at one point in high school, there was early on in high school, there's some test that you take. It kind of lets you know what kind of fields you may really enjoy. And I took this test, and I remember lawyer was one of the occupations. And then
play one on TV.
You see, and then when I thought about it, I was like, oh yeah, I would love to do corporate law. So for myself, I really did plan to go and like dance, theater, acting was always a hobby. From a kid into my teen years, it was always a hobby for me. So when I got to Seton Hall, I was definitely planning on I was going to Seton Hall, and my next step in my mind was going to be Seton Hall Law, and I was going to be a corporate lawyer. That was my plan. But then Savion Glover came calling. And he said he had this show that he was working on that he was doing at the Public Theater. He needed one more dancer. And he said, well, you know, what you doing? I said, well, I'm here in Jersey. I'm going to school. Can't get my degree. He said, well, come on through. Came on through. And the next thing I knew, that was our Bring Your Noise, Bring the Funk. Mm-hmm. But then the conflict of that time, because as Noise Funk was going on, I was pursuing acting and still trying to get my degree. It didn't all, the timing of everything didn't really work. And I'll never forget, there was like one class that I had, and I had a midterm. I had a midterm. The teacher only gave a midterm and a final, and that was it. And we had a matinee for the show, and we didn't have any understudies at the time. So I told the teacher, I said, look, I'm doing this show off Broadway called Bring Your Noise, Bring the Funk. He said, what? Called what? I said, Bring Your Noise, Bring the Funk. It's, you know, it's at this theater in New York. We don't have any understudies. I can't miss the show. Can I take my midterm early? He said, no. He said, no. I said, but sir, if I don't take the midterm, you only have two classes. So I'm going to fail.
Yeah.
Long story short, in the end, he said, you have to decide whether you want to become an actor or do you want to get your college degree? Which is it's an asshole thing to say.
It's bullshit. Yeah.
Yeah.
I had a teacher like that too. No, you can't come in a day early because of your track meet. I don't think you should be at Cornell University if you want to pursue sports. It's one or the other. I'm like, bitch, I'm a senior. Can we not with this right now?
Like, exactly.
I made it through 3.5 years. Just like,
I was a junior at the time. I was a junior. I was like, come on. Like, and I'm not asking for a favor. I'm asking for more time.
Yeah, you're doing the work. Yeah.
He wouldn't do it. So in the end, that moment, I ended up having to take an incomplete. And then that moment allowed me to start to say, what do I really want to do? What do I really want to do with my life? Am I trying to get my college degree or do I want to have a career in the arts? And when I decided to have a career in the arts, so I eventually left Seton Hall and then I enrolled in acting class at William Esper Studios in New York while I was doing Bringing Noise on Broadway. And then, as they say, the rest is history. Next thing I know, I'm working with James Rodé Rodriguez.
That's right. Next thing you know, you're on Sarah Spain's podcast.
You see what I'm saying?
The star keeps just, you know, shooting higher and higher.
That's what she said.
When was Jim Henson's City Kids?
Ooh. Jim Henson's City Kids was my senior year of high school. Yeah, my senior year of high school going into right before my freshman year of college. That was 1993, I believe.
Were there Muppets? Did you get
there
to
were
work?
Muppets.
Nice.
Yeah. They were like the, they were supposed to be like the next generation of Muppets.
But okay.
Obviously, it was not because.
Yeah.
Here's the funny thing about.
We never heard about City Adults. It never really.
Exactly. Yeah. There's no spinoff.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. City Kids, we came out the same year. We both were Saturday morning shows. We came out the same year as this show that we swore we were like, oh, we're going to kill that show. Oh, that's ridiculous. Please. That show is not going to do well at all. The other show that was our competition was a show called The Power Rangers.
Oh, okay. Just a little indie like, show.
And we're looking at it, we're like, what? Like, what are they doing? Like, this is so stupid. Like, oh my gosh.
That's funny.
They're jumping
that's
around these
great
costumes. And we have the Muppets. We're going to be fine. We were canceled like in, I think, like 6 weeks. Of course, Power Rangers has gone off to become.
Of course, yeah. I asked a part. I worked at Jim Henson for a summer in college. I was a PR intern there.
Ooh.
And it was this funny balance of, they had a bunch of, by that point, other shows and things that had nothing to do with the Muppets. But the end of summer party was this big thing. And they had like a Kermit ice luge that like the boss was taking shots out of. And then went into this little closet, like homemade booth thing, and you put these headphones on and it was like Miss Piggy and Kermit talking dirty to each other. Like it was all this shit that I was like, holy cow, the Muppets people are wild. Like, cause you know, at that point it's just a party for the people who work there and they're just messing with all the characters. But
the wildest parties were going to be the Muppet parties. Who knew?
Yeah, you never knew. You never knew the Muppet parties get freaky. Actually, the one
never
of the people
knew the Muppet
that,
parties were going to get freaky, and then I never knew that, you know, Power Rangers
were going to be a hit. They did get freaky. One of the employees was secretly sleeping with the head of maintenance on the set, on the lot, and the lot was Charlie Chaplin's old. It's a really cool place to work in LA. It's right on La Cienega. It's like Charlie Chaplin's old set of different like houses, and they got so drunk that they fell asleep in the car. In the lot. So people came back to work the next morning and they were passed out together. And that's how everyone found out that they were boning.
Wow.
Anyway, it was memories.
What are the lessons that we are learning?
Exactly.
Lessons we're learning here.
Yeah. Yeah. It turns out, you know, Kermit and Miss Piggy might be gateway drugs to bad acts, you know,
might be gateway drugs. Huh?
That's right. Okay. So how old are you when you end up on the West Wing? Very young for, and you'd obviously done stuff, but that's a huge role for an early in your career.
I was 23, I believe.
That's
I believe
wild.
I come to LA because I left Norris Funk, came to LA, did a movie called She's All That.
Mm-hmm.
I did not work for about a year after that. And I remember everyone kept gassing me up. They were like, oh, you all like the new Brat Pack. Yeah. You like the new teeny bopper people. Yeah. Oh, you're going to, it's Miramax. You're going to work, man. Oh, this next policy is, oh my gosh, you're going to be having to turn things away. There was nothing. There was nothing. Now, I'll still never forget going to the premiere of She's All That. You know, when we're going down the press line and everyone's like, how does it feel to be a part of like the new Brat Pack and putting the mic? And in my mind, all I kept thinking was, I need a job. Like, I need a
yeah.
job. Like, it wasn't
the
like
next
the
one. Yeah.
yeah
it's
like,
been a while since we actually stopped filming on this. And, it doesn't feel like that to you, but.
Yeah, and like Freddie and Rachel, they, you know, they got a nice check, but my character, I didn't have a lot of television or film stuff out there. So I didn't really get paid that much dough at all. So I'm like, I need a job. Anyway. So I did that, didn't work for about a year. And then leading up to that summer, my agent had dropped me because I hadn't booked anything. And I'll never forget, I was in my apartment. If I talked to the agency dropped me, not my agent, but I you know, she had to drop me, but it was the agency. Yeah. When I was in my apartment after having a conversation with her during that time, she said, you know, you really got to book something or the agency is going to drop you. I got off the phone with her and I remember saying to myself, Dulé, you're either going to be a successful actor or you're going to spend the rest of your life trying. Mm-hmm. Like I just made that commitment to myself of either way, you have no control over necessarily whether you'll become a successful actor, like known and this and that and have a bona fide career, but you do have control over your commitment to it and how much you're willing to keep pressing towards your goal. So I made that commitment. And then a few months later, a casting director, Kevin Scott, who had auditioned me a year before for a project that I didn't get, had remembered me. So he searched me out when Charlie came up. And when the role came up, he searched me out, brought me in to read for Aaron Sorkin and Tommy Schlamme. And then the next thing I know, I was on the set with Martin Sheen and Rob Lowe and Allison Janney.
It's wild.
It really was mind-boggling. I mean, because I'll never forget, like during that time, maybe about 3 weeks before I booked that role, maybe a month, I was over at Freddie Prinze Jr.'s house because, you know, we were very good friends then and we're still friends now. And I said, Freddie, man, if I don't get a job soon, I'm either coming to live with you or I'm going back to New Jersey because I do not have any more money. I have bill to last like another month or 6 weeks to 2 months. And that's about it. And then next thing I know, West Wing came along.
Well, and I was just reading in, there was an interview you did, I think, for Vanity Fair about the West Wing reunion recently in support of a couple different things. But When We All Vote, I think, was what that particular reunion was for. And you mentioned that it was tough at the time for you to have your big break kind of marred by racism in the way that people reacted to your character, in the fact that your character was added because the NAACP had complained about the ensemble not having people of color in it. You're 23. It's a huge break. Like you just said, you're walking onto a set with these incredible people, but there was some part of you still that was affected by it not feeling right.
Right. Yeah. I mean, here's the thing. And I don't know which came first, whether the character was always planned to be there or whether it was in reaction to what the, you know, to the NAACP speaking out against it. I know, Aaron Sorkin says the plan was always for that character to come. But either way, I appreciate all the moving pieces that went on. I appreciate the fact that the NAACP did speak out against it because, I mean, yeah, it was an issue. when you see a show about the most powerful place on the planet and there's no people who look like you or even anybody else besides, you know, white Americans, then that is a message that's being sent out. So, I mean, but I was appreciative of being on the show. I mean, it's a big break. It's a chance to finally break through this television thing. I actually made a goal of getting getting a television series at the age of 15. It took me 8 years to actually see that come to fruition. So yeah, finally booked this show with Martin Sheen and Allison Janney and Rob Lowe. And my last agent just dropped me a few months ago. Now,
it's a big moment. But then
it's also shining a light, but also in the midst of it, it did. I mean, I can't say it took away from the experience. I think it was more, it was a shame that even had to be a part of the conversation.
Right.
I was glad that the conversation was there because it needs to be there and it still needs to be there today. Mm. We need to always shine a light when we see a void, but it would have been better to not have to, if it was never an issue because there was enough diversity on television in the first place.
Well, and it's hard to imagine that this was 1999, almost 2000, and your character kissing a white character caused people to write in. So it wasn't just the part about the casting, but your reaction to your character was also disheartening to you in the sense that people were still in 1999 angry about that.
That part was definitely, that part was what affected me more. I mean, like the fact of, you know, the calling out of the lack of diversity didn't really affect me that much. I mean, I appreciated it because that wasn't just something that was just reflective of that show. It was reflective across the industry, which is why it was so hard for people of color to find jobs. And to this day, that still is an issue. Mm-hmm. It still is a lack of diversity in front of the camera and behind the camera. But the reaction of people, the fact that we got hate mail about a fake character dating another fake character who was of a different race, or the president's daughter, and people took it so personally. Mm-hmm. I'm like, it doesn't surprise me. Like, little seeds like that back then, you know, when I saw those seeds, it doesn't surprise me when I see where we are now as a country, because it's that same thing of like, what we get caught up in such of the most trivial things concerning differences of people,
right,
instead of just.
Yeah. Well, and those letters are, you know, one of the ways that people used to vocalize that. And now it's much easier to vocalize those feelings on social media. So as much as we think things are getting worse, a lot of those sentiments were always there. We just are exposed to them. And so our naivete or our sort of innocence about how terrible people are in our country is maybe more in the forefront for those of us who don't experience it every day.
I completely agree. Because it's so much easier to, you know, send it out far and wide now.
Yes, even
now,
exactly.
For example, that would be West Wing getting tweeted. That would be me getting tweeted. Yeah. That would be Aaron Sorkin getting tweeted. Yeah. You know, posted about on Facebook, on Instagram. It would be that. Back then, all you could do was write a letter.
Right. In some ways, it was better that way.
For real, yeah, exactly.
It disappeared into the ether when you burned it in a bonfire.
it didn't contaminate the entire.
Right, other people didn't. Yeah,
because we knew about it.
Bear witness to it the same way.
All the audience, exactly.
Yeah. What did you learn about government and the office of the president? And, you know, it's obviously an alternate universe, but very much based in reality. And it's interesting, especially, I think, when you devote that many years of your life to something, how you become, people don't think that you're actually an officer of the government, but they do like look to you for comfort during times like we're in now. And that's why those reunions were a huge deal to people. This idyllic place where a democracy runs and is based on doing what's right feels nice right now. And distant. How much did you actually feel like you knew about that or still know based on that job?
I mean, I learned a lot during the process because I was able to meet and converse and interact with a lot of people who were in government. They actually did the work that we were, you know, showing that we were reflecting. They were the ones really in the trenches doing it. And what I learned then was that the majority of people in government are people who really want to do service to the nation. They want to do what's right for the nation. They want to move the nation forward. There are different points of views of how to do that. But back then, especially, I felt, no, I mean, we don't agree politically, or even not policy-wise, but I can see that you are really just wanting to do what you feel is right for the country. I don't feel that that's the case now, though. And mm-hmm. that's what's disheartening for me, because back then, there were all different people from all along the spectrum in terms of the political spectrum.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, and I hear your argument, and I don't agree with some things, but I can understand where your point of view is coming from. It's not just so much about disenfranchising people or hating people or not
right.
wanting to let people in, per se. But now, I just, it feels such a... It's more challenging to me. I mean, I wish a show like West Wing was out that could help, I guess, get people to dream again about what we could be, or at least see
right. how we what could it looks be. Like to be functioning and
to be functioning. And
right.
And then also, I mean, I'm kind of just going off on tangents, but it's like there were really brilliant people on all sides of an issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm talking about in the real world.
In the real world. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like
everyone could name the three branches of government before being elected to serve any of them.
Exactly. Yeah. And people like really knew it. I'm like, okay, no, you're in this because you know this stuff. The people who, for lack of better words, the dummies did not outnumber the brilliant minds.
Yeah. Well, that's why I think a lot of people are going back to watch The West Wing and to revisit what it felt like for them in that time and what it feels like now and how pieces of the show now looking at our current state read and hit differently. I'm curious, you know, you left or you announced that you were leaving, then you found out the show was wrapping shortly after, so you returned for the final episodes.
Yeah, okay. I mean,
what's wrong? You're giving me the face like the internet lied to me.
Well, no, the internet didn't lie to you, but it's funny how like things play themselves out. When I announced, quote unquote, that I was leaving, I was given the opportunity to do 5 episodes of the final season.
Oh, okay.
I didn't necessarily know it was going to definitely be the final
season. It was a conscious uncoupling, is what you're saying?
Yes. For example.
Were you Gwyneth or Chris Martin in this?
who wanted to stay?
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
But like, here's the thing. It's like John Wells had called me because John Wells produced the show. And I love John. Like, he's been a great friend over the years. And I've learned a lot from him over the years. He called me and he said, budgetary things are going on with the show and this and that. We don't know. He said, really, truly, I think this is going to be the last season of the show. But our budgets from what our licensing fee is going down, of what the studio or what the network is willing to pay for the show, all these budget constrictions and blah, blah, blah. So we're staggering people's episode order. Okay, so Brad's doing this, Allison's doing this, blah, 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 right. Blah, blah. And for you, we want to have you come and do 5. Now, this is still my first series, so I didn't know. So I said, oh, okay, I'm doing 5, okay. So am I still getting paid for all 22? Mm. He was like,
it's a hard no.
Yeah, no, that's not how it works. But what he did say, he would do for me, though. He said, I know that, 5 episodes out of 22, that's a big difference in salary and this and that. But what I will do is we'll film those 5 episodes based off of your schedule.
That's good.
So right. This season coming up, you can go and
do other work.
Pursue right. other job.
Did you have psych in the can or see, did you know it was coming?
That's the key. See, because John offered that up, it allowed me to go and do psych. So I did the psych pilot. I did like 1 or 2 episodes of West Wing. Then I went and did a movie called The Guardian. And then right after The Guardian, I went and did the psych pilot. Then I came back and finished the next 3 episodes of The West Wing. And during that time, psych had got picked up.
Got
so by the time I finished my final episode of West Wing, 2 weeks later, I went up to Vancouver to start filming Psych. But it's because he said, I will do it around your schedule.
Yeah.
Not saying these
That's
are
so
things.
Great, though, to have that you know you're onto a next project right away. Probably a bit of fear. One of the interesting things in talking to James about Psych was that he had been either in smaller things or ensemble cast kind of things where it wasn't up to him whether it would sink or swim. Mm-hmm. But with Psych, that was you two guys. Like, there's of course other great characters and it's about the writing and the fun of it. But how much pressure was it to go from West Wing, where a lot of the weight is on the shoulders of the Martin Sheens and the Allison Jannies, to now this is my project and I'm one of 2 that's running this show?
Well, funny is because the West Wing was my first series, I didn't have any of that thought of it's not going to work.
Right. Which is the opposite of James, who's everything else failed. And then I'm like, what was the difference with Psych? And he said, it was just you that you were around. So
I was like, hey, we're going to go where, of course we're going to go run for 7 or 8 years. Like that's
yeah.
in my mind. Like that's
You're
what
spoiled. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's what you do. You come and you do a TV show and, so for me, I didn't have
you win a bunch of Emmys and SAG awards, and then everybody tells you you're great.
we'll be at the award show. Don't worry, Rose. we'll be there. Now that part I got completely wrong.
Yeah,
because we never made it to any of the award shows. But I did. But for me, I just didn't have that. It wasn't even in my mind that we would not be picked up and that we would not go in at least have a few seasons anyway.
Yeah.
My thought always was if the network, if USA would give us a little window to find ourselves, that we could possibly have something that would be brilliant and people would enjoy.
Yeah.
And thankfully, they really gave us that leg room, because on network television, they'll cut you in a heartbeat.
Yeah. Being on USA and not having a lot of the signature shows to build off of, you had a lot of space to figure yourselves out.
Exactly. But here's the thing I will say, though. Like, I know Rodé said, just have me on the show. But he forgot to mention a show that came after Psych called Doubt. And I doubt any of you have seen it because it came and went very quickly. And then you all also probably are missing a little movie called Whisper.
Do not remember Whisper.
That was before Psych. That was the movie I was doing in Vancouver when John called me to tell me that I was only going to come back and do 5 episodes of The West Wing.
Yeah, so interesting.
Whisper was a whisper.
It was a whisper. Yeah.
So there are some
It said, go back to TV. And you listened. And you listened.
Go back to TV.
Yeah. You were like, movies? Psych. And
you're
then
not welcome here. You're not welcome here.
Yeah.
That's what she said.
So what happens when you realize a couple years in or however long in that Psych is that kind of cult hit that has fans called psychos, that you're going to go to like a Comic-Con, that people are going to notice every little detail and plot twist in the way that they do with a show like that?
It was kind of a mind-boggling, you know what I mean? Because the West Wing had fans, but not in that same way. You know, it wasn't like the psychos are on a whole other magnificent level. Mm-hmm. I remember when we first were going to go to the Comic-Con, and they said they wanted to put us in one of the big halls. I think it's like Hall H or something like that. And I remember thinking, like, are these folks crazy? Like, what? Like, it's gonna be echo chamber in there. Like, we're on USA. We're just like the little show over here that's having fun. Like, what are they doing? And when we came out, I was really blown away. I was taken aback by the engagement and the love, because we shot in Vancouver. The show didn't air in Canada at the time, so we were just in our own little bubble up there working. And I was really blown away at how much people were engaged. And then as we had the panels, and then of course, when social media started to really find its rise, I was just, you know, pleasantly surprised at how much people knew about the show.
Right.
Like, to this Psychos know way more about Psych than I do.
Yeah, I bet they do. They have a little more free time probably to keep watching it over and over while you're creating new things. But it's an interesting kind of formula, those shows, where like the West Wing is many awards and there are obviously fans, but it's telling this broad, deep intellectual story versus a show like Psych, or like the example I used with James was Community, which is my Psych. If there was such a thing as a community psycho, that would be me. And I think a lot of it is the ones that have a lot of freedom to play with form. And
have you had a Yvette Nicole Brown on the show?
I haven't, but I would love to. Joel McHale has exchanged about 11 emails with me, all promising to come on. And then he has to do the Tiger King reunion special. And that really put a wrench in everything. Speaking of whispers. But yeah, we're working on it. But it's the same vibe, right? Like they get to do shows that are, you know, stop animation or where they're singing for no reason. Like, and the way that Psycho got into some of those referential episodes where they're reflecting back on other movies or shows or things like that, I think that's, it draws people in a way that's so different from a regular show.
Yeah. I remember when we did, it was kind of like this back to back thing. Cause I think one was either the season finale or an episode near the end of season one, which was our Scary Sherry. Mm-hmm. And then we had American Duos, which was the top of season two. And those two together, I feel, really let us know what we could, where we could go with the show of, oh no, we could do all sorts of, we could pay homages to genres.
Yeah,
we can take one pop culture thing that's happening and turn it on its side and make and have our own fun with it. And really the sky's the limit of whatever. Once we got those two shows out there, it really became we could do whatever we want to do. And I think that's what allowed people to stay engaged over the years, because we were just in our own different lane than what a lot of other.
Totally. Yeah. And it's just fun and joyful and unrestricted. You guys were obviously very good friends. James was a groomsman in your wedding and you guys reunited for the Psych 2 Lassie Come Home, one of many reunions this year. From your first meeting, was it clear you would hit it off when you got together and read, or was it a relationship that sort of grew with the show?
I think from the beginning, like I feel like I'm a fairly easy dude, where as long as you're not an asshole, then.
Right. So far to me, you've been really difficult.
It's
different over Zoom.
I got to flip up sometimes. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
No one can see that I'm like flipping you off. And
I mean, I can, and it hurts, but yeah.
But you know, I mean, that's the whole point. I'm trying to hurt you.
Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah. But with James, the intention was good.
Yeah. I mean, so when I first met him, was a chemistry read, because he had already had the role. And I came in and we set it up and I came in, we met and we did the scene. And, you know, of course, I'm coming from the world of Aaron Sorkin, where you say the words. Mm. What's written on the paper is what you say. Rodé is Rodé. He's magnificently Rodé, but he still is Rodé. So he, you know, we start this scene and this cat is like, he's like on this roller coaster. He's like this little fly buzzing around. And I'm like, brother, what are you doing? Are you trying to Are you trying to sabotage my performance? Yeah. You got a friend you want to get into this role or something? Like, what's that? But we did that. And then actually, when I was going to actually go to network, he came out to my house to, I guess, to rehearse a little bit. And in that moment is when I was like, okay, this cat's a cool cat. We can really
vibe. Awesome.
But really, I got to say, when it really started to gel was once we started doing the pilot. And then we both realized that we had a love of 80s music. And we just started, like, that's how we really started to bond. And over the pilot, we just cracked each other up. We both, I realized that he was coming from a humble place also, that he wanted to just come and have a good time. Oftentimes when you can work with actors, especially at that age, you know, we still were younger actors, people can come with a lot of ego. Mm-hmm. And although they'll be cool in one thing, and then once they get to the set, now this ego comes out. But he had none of that. And that really, I think, allowed us to bond. It was a mutual respect we had for each other's gifts and what we brought and what we brought to the project.
What's it like working with actors that you don't get along with? Have you had long-term shows where there's somebody that when you see them outside the set, you're like, oh, I want to punch that person?
Thankfully, no. I mean, all the shows that I've been on, I mean, like West Wing, Psych, Ballers, Suits, those are the four like long running shows, and I've enjoyed everybody that I've worked with.
That's awesome.
Which is a huge blessing, because I don't know if I have the, I've never had to, and by God's grace, I will never have to. I don't know if I have that ability to navigate that, because I don't play, like in life, I don't play those games. It's like, there's no reason to be rude.
Yeah.
There's no reason to be rude. And if you're going to just blatantly be rude to myself and to other people, we're going to have a problem.
Yeah. You know, and in the acting world, for sure, that's out there. There's people that are insufferable.
Yeah, but I think what's good also is that to inquire before, either if I'm on a hiring side, then inquire before I hire, or if I'm getting hired, inquire before I get hired. It's like, who is,
right?
Because I know that you're working with a nutcase over
and
there.
And what are they about? Yeah, yeah.
Everyone has to be on the same page before I come in, because this is not, thankfully, like, for example, working on the West Wing, Martin Sheen set the bar for me. This is how I'd come from the teen movie world, and I saw how egos can run amok in that world. And then right on the heels of that, to go work with Martin Sheen, it really showed, like, okay, this is how you don't have to be an asshole. You actually can be a very,
and if anyone had a right to be, right, that's setting the tone. So no one else can walk in there and try to act all chesty around Martin Sheen if he's not being that way. It's funny. I just was texting with someone yesterday who used to work with this total a-hole in our industry. And I'm like, I still don't know how you did it for so long. He's like, I'm much chiller than you. And I'm like, that's true. That's actually true. You know, like, I don't suffer fools very well, so I don't do well around assholes.
It wouldn't work for me in the long term. I mean, thankfully, as time goes on, there's less of a chance of that happening, because as your career grows, you start having a little bit more of a footprint.
True.
So it'd be one thing if it's my first show and then I'm working with an asshole.
Right.
But I think any show that I do, it's like, I know that I'm standing on the right side of it. It's like, there's no reason to be an asshole. We don't need to be treating people like shit.
Right. And you set the tone now, because you're one of those people that's established and a veteran. So other people are going to look to you and see how you're acting. And then you reflect to them what you want to see.
We had that too, where sometimes if a director came in, especially, or even an actor, a guest actor came in and tried to really bring some funny energy, we would shut it down in a heartbeat. If it was a director and they had the energy for this episode, as soon as it was a wrap, it was like, yeah.
Not that one again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It wasn't even a, can we not have them come back? It was like, they're not coming back.
Right, right.
We're not doing that here. We treat everybody with love. We're having fun. We laugh, period.
Yeah.
I try to be a thermostat, not a thermometer. Where I try to affect the environment that I enter into, not be affected by the environment that I'm entering into. We can be reactors, or, you know, we can be, you know, I don't know what the word is, but we can be someone who actually changes something. So whenever I walk into a room, I try to bring good energy and then let that be the energy is going to be. It's like, if Julie's coming around, it's going to be a good vibe, because it's just what it is.
Yeah. Well, that's so important too, though. Like, it's kind of wild from the outside when you watch a show for a long time, you do feel committed to it and you understand the length of it. But when you put it into years and then for whatever reason, no matter how old I am, I'm always going to think of everything based on like 4 years of high school, 4 years of college. Like I've been with my husband for like 11 years now. And I'm like, shit, how have we been together longer than all of high school and college? Yep. Like, that's wild. So I think about like you guys doing shows. And when you're done after an 8 or 9 or 10 year run, that's a really long time to spend so much time with other people. So it's all the more important that you enjoy that and that, you know, it isn't a terrible environment.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, here's the thing too. I think you also have to get past, like, even as you enter into something, not make it about you, because we all have our own insecurities and this and that. And you and I are working together and say one day you were in a bad mood and you start having some attitudes,
right,
I can start taking it personally.
Right.
Like I gotta show her, or I can just try to just calm the waters.
Mm-hmm.
And over time show like we don't need to go that way.
Right.
I think I cannot make it about me.
Mm-hmm.
It helps to.
It happens a lot in radio too. We got to do two or three hours every night. So it's not like every day you're going to show up and be like, hey guys, let's talk Monday Night Football. Sometimes you're like, I had the worst day. I need you to pick me up today. So it's good. It's good when you have those people around you.
Funny you say the thing about high school and college. That's what I say about the West Wing in sight, because it was 7 years of West Wing, which is the exact time that I did high school and college, because I left my junior year.
Yeah.
And 8 years of psych. It's like, that's a long time. That's like having a friend that you meet your freshman year of high school, and then you all go to the same university.
Yeah.
Take all the same classes.
It's a relationship, basically. You're basically like work married to somebody.
They're, like, they're still family to me. It's like they're all psycho, like the psychos are family to me. The psych cast is family to me. The West Wing, you know, I've always called it the West Wing family, because we really are.
Yeah. And you grew up with them. I mean, 23. That's growing up with them. So now you're on Suits. And
I was on Suits.
You were. So you're off. You're done with your is Suits done?
The Suits is. Yeah. The whole show.
Oh,
done.
Really? OK.
Yes,
I don't think I realized that it wrapped. And you missed the whole Meghan Markle era.
No, I did not. I was there for her final season.
Oh, OK.
Yeah.
What was that like? What a weird, what an odd thing. Like, it's so random.
I mean, look, I mean, I don't even try to go into conversations like that, because that's a whole other. As soon as you start saying something about Meghan Markle, it's like, hold on. It's like, yeah, I'm like, hold on.
Why? Because you get asked about it all the time?
No, because I mean, she was the Duchess. I don't know if she still is.
Yeah, there's a lot there now. I just think of all the random things. To have someone on your show be getting tons of attention because they married a royal is such a weird and specific thing.
Probably for more the rest of the cast, it probably was more weird because they worked with her for a long period of time.
Right.
And then the season that I joined the cast, we were on the set together, but we didn't have scenes together. And we have mutual friends. So like we spoke and this and that, but
yeah,
she was nice. She was cool. It's like anybody else. You know, she just had a.
That's good though. If she was like anybody else, that's just. I think it'd be so weird. It's like a lot of things go viral now, and attention is different now than it ever was before because it's so splintered. Right, back in the day, people always use the Little House on the Prairie example, but like we all just watched the same like five shows and talked about the same five people, and now so many disparate places that people are giving their time and attention and interest. But that was one of those sort of wild things where someone becomes the focus of every Us Weekly and every whatever, which is crazy. So Suits is done. I didn't realize that. So are you in search of your next high school / college experience?
I actually am. I am. I don't know. Here's the thing. I don't know if I would. I mean, yeah, that's not true. I mean, I probably would do another show for 7 years, 8 years, but I'm also cool with doing a show for 3 years or 4 years.
Yeah.
I like being able to. I love the idea of doing a long-running show, but I also love the idea of changing characters and being able to keep challenging myself. Because once you do a long show, it gets to a point where you can really just do it with your eyes closed. It's like even like Psych now, if we go and do it, if we're blessed to do another Psych movie, as soon as Rodé and I get together, and it's like we're right back into the characters.
Yeah.
It's not like we have to go do this whole, I got to figure out what these moments mean for Gus and this and that. You played Gus for
a long time. You know him well.
He started in 2006. It's like, if you don't know Gus by now, brother, but I'm looking to see what is next though.
I think what's next is probably a tap dancing show with you and your son based on your social media.
You know what I'm saying?
you're like already getting him ready for his own version of the telethon.
You see what I'm saying? He's so much joy. We have a wonderful time. And it's funny because he actually gets me to dance more now because he'll be like, you know, garage, you want to go to the garage. And he'll go have like this Murphy floor, I call it, where the dance floor is up, it's fastened against the wall.
Yeah.
And I pull the car out and then I bring it down. Yeah. So he'll want me to bring it down and he'll want, like, tap shoes.
Yeah.
And once I have on the tap shoes, then I'm going to start dancing. So
cool.
But we'll see what the next opportunities are. I do have a movie coming out. I don't know when it's coming out, but it's called Lockdown.
Okay.
A Doug Liman film that myself and my wife Jasmine Simon were blessed to be a part of.
Oh, fun.
Anne Hathaway, Chiwetel Ejiofor, Ben Stiller, Stephen Merchant.
Nice cast.
Fun cast. And we had a chance to play a role in there. So
we'll keep an eye out for it. Yeah.
This game is always a hustle. We're like a traveling circus.
That's
this thing called show business.
Every day you're hustling. That's the job. Before I let you go, there's one thing you have to do. It's the thing that everybody gets, but nobody expects.
Didn't expect a kind of Spanish Inquisition. Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition.
It's the Spanish Inquisition, number one. What's your desert island album? You can only have one.
Uprising by Bob Marley.
Nice. That's a good one for an island. Number two, what habit or quality do you think has contributed most to your success?
Humbleness and commitment.
Ooh, those are good ones.
Humbleness, commitment, and faith.
Number three, what would you consider your biggest failure?
My biggest failure? I was going to say
What were you going to say?
I was going to say my first marriage.
I knew you were going to say that. The way you laughed, there was something in the tone. I was like, I bet he's going to say his first marriage.
All things work together for the good. You know what
yes,
I'm saying?
That qualifies. That absolutely qualifies. Number four, have you ever been in a fist fight?
Once.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's good. I like that.
Yeah.
Number five, if you could switch lives with anyone for one day, who would it be?
Anyone for one day? Jeff Bezos. And in that one day, I would take so much of his dough and spread it out and sow goodness in the world.
I like that answer.
I'm like, yeah, give this here. Like, how much would it cost to take care of homelessness let's start small. Let's start in America.
What a wonderful feeling that would be.
I would just write the check. It's gone. And by the time he came back, he would lose his mind.
By the time he came back, he would have made it all back. In the hour that you were gone.
He wouldn't even know what happened to him.
Yeah, yeah. He wouldn't notice, unfortunately.
But people would really just love him so much more. They'd be like, wow.
Exactly. Yeah.
Thank you.
We need to do like a Jeff Bezos, Christmas story. Where he meets, the ghosts of future and past and everything, and he becomes, the most beloved American.
And this is like, it's a tangent, but I don't understand, like some of the issues I see, especially during this time, this COVID time that we're in. Why is there people struggling the way that they are? There is enough wealth within this country alone that if you just took some of them.
We have been for some time, and we continue to be going the wrong direction, where the most rich among us, CEOs did not used to make what they made proportionate to the employees that worked for them. And we've never put a halt on it. And the train is running off the tracks. And the way to make a difference now feels so drastic to people, even though had we done things right long ago, we never would have gotten here.
See, I'm not even talking about even like legislatively. I'm talking just about what's going on inside of us where someone can have all of this money and not say, you know what? I don't need 30 of this building. Right now, let me release 30 of this building.
Right.
Billions to 2 billion of it, 3 billion, 10 billion.
Mm-hmm.
Collectively, let's do that to really make sure that people are not going hungry. People let's cover all the rents over here.
Yeah.
For the next 6 months. Let's do it. Why not? There's so much wealth in this.
Especially now, like holiday season, and you see like all the shit that you can buy, and you're like, why do we need that? Can't we do something else with whatever you spent to make that shitty thing that no one needs?
That's what's heartbreaking to me is during this time, I'm realizing our lack of character. And I think that's been the most heartbreaking thing for me of what's happening in our country right now is I'm realizing is we as a nation, our character is off right now because we somehow, somewhere along the way, we stop thinking about our neighbor. We stop thinking about how can we support each other? How can we lift each other up? Let me be inconvenienced a little bit so that you can be okay.
It's a very weird thing where we are more connected than ever to the world because of technology, but we are much less connected to the people right next to us. And because of that, we then create this distance and space where we don't reach out to them to help. And we also don't reach out to them for help. And so everybody feels alone. And then you don't see other human beings the same way you used to, where we're all in this together kind of vibes, which is a big issue and is a big part of all the other issues that we're having now are
and
a lot.
And maybe that's these extremely wealthy people, these extreme billionaires.
The Bezoses.
Yeah, maybe they are doing stuff that just isn't really out there.
Oh, I'm sure they're doing a lot, but they could do more and we could hear about it more.
Yeah,
and then it could trickle down to other people.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Get out my mind, Sarah. Get out my mind.
We should do it. Let's start with our billions.
Exactly.
Number six, what's the most embarrassed you've ever been?
The most embarrassed I've ever been? I don't even know what that is. You know how that ain't? The most embarrassed?
I love how people are always stumped. Like, I've never been embarrassed. Realized human who's secure with myself at all times.
I'm trying to think, what did maybe I just try to like knock it out the side of my head, you know?
Yeah. You've moved on. It's a way to get through life. Usually people's do revert back to something in childhood involving, like farting or peeing their pants, like, or tripping. That's usually what most stays with people for life.
I don't really have something. I'm like, oh,
title for the podcast, Dulé Hill, never embarrassed. I respect that. I really do. I really do. But now I'm going to be trying to find a time when you're embarrassed. I'm going to search the internet for something embarrassing. Number seven, what's the thing about yourself you'd most like to improve?
The thing about myself that I would most like to improve. Probably to be able to like stand up for myself more concerning like emotional issues or relational connection. And
right.
I can say, this is what I need.
Okay. That's a good one.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Number eight, if you could be commissioner of life for a day, what one rule would you enforce that all of society would have to adhere to?
Commissioner of life for a day?
Mm-hmm.
Wear a mask.
That's what your buddy James Rodé said.
You see, that's why we get along so well.
Making the world a better place. Number nine, what's the most scared you've ever been?
The most scared I've ever been is probably, when I was about 10 years old and I did this horse ride. I was during the tap dance kid and I was doing this here in Los Angeles and a lot of the cast was doing this horse ride along this trail, and I'm this little 10-year-old kid, and I want to do it too. I want to go. And of course, this horse that I had, I'd never really been on a horse before. And my mom had said, like, I think that's going to be too much for you. I don't think you should do it. No, mommy, I want to do it. So then I get on a horse, and we're going through the trail, and then they tell me, you pull to the left, the horse will go to the left. You pull to the right, the horse will go to the right. So the cliff is to the right. So I pull to the right, the horse goes to the right. I pull to the left, the horse goes to the right. It just kept walking right along the side of the cliff. And when I tell you, I was so scared, I had to like take the horse to the checkpoint. I still remember to this day. I've not been back on a horse since.
Ah.
10 years old and I have not been back on a horse. I'm 45, 35 years later.
Get back on the horse. It's not just a euphemism. You need to actually literally get back on a horse.
I don't know.
I'm going to say user error. I'm going to say you thought you were telling it to go left, but you probably were like digging in your heel too to tell it to go right. And the horse was very confused and potentially suicidal and was considering ending it all.
And here's like a little trivia to that too is in The Tap Dance Kid is an actress by the name of Dawn Lewis, who played Jaleesa on A Different World.
Mm-hmm.
Dawn Lewis is Dawn Lewis.
Yeah.
So Dawn was like my big sister. But back then in the 80s, when we got to the checkpoint, she had to pay money so that they could take her horse and the other horse back without us being on it. Because I was like, I'm not getting back. No, I'm not.
So Did she want to go back and she stayed with you?
Yep. And she had to drive
That's
me home.
Nice. That's nice.
I was like, Dawn, no, I'm not going to.
So. Well, I'm going to say that's your most embarrassing moment, that you let a horse at the age of 10 beat you for life and you've never gotten back on.
See? Well, there you go.
I'm gonna dial into whoever's writing that next psych movie, and there will be a horseback riding scene to get you past this moment in your life. Number 10, what three words would you most hope that people would use to describe you?
Kind. Passionate. Wait for it. I would say kind, passionate, humble. Yeah.
Like the wait for it. You slipped that in. Finally, who should I have on the show? It can be anyone from anywhere that's interesting.
Yvette Nicole Brown.
Yes. I do need to have her on. I've been rewatching all of Community, and I especially want to talk to her about her singing. It's so good.
Mm-hmm.
I was just watching the musical episode where they're singing with Sarah Bareilles.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's a good one. Do you know her personally from work stuff or just life?
She came and did psych, and she's a friend, and you know, I've got a lot of love for her.
Perfect. I'll be sure to drop your name.
Yeah. Oh yeah. YNB. Come on, YNB. Come on,
YNB. Thank you so much for doing this. It was really fun. And I'm glad I followed James's suggestion to start watching psych before this. So, you know, I came into the interview a little more knowledgeable. Not about suits though.
You know what? See, not about suits. You know, I have one thing to offer up. Here's a situation. This wasn't embarrassing. I don't know if this is my most embarrassing.
Oh, okay.
This was a situation. This was a situation. So I'm hanging out in DC, you know, hanging out with my cousins at this club, hanging out, having a good time. Me and this lady, we meet. I rented a limo for the night. So we were going somewhere. I forgot where we had to go. We were like going somewhere to do something and then come back. So like, we're talking, this and that. I was talking before, you know, I was like yippity yappity going back and forth and talked about like, you know, undressing and this and that. And she was like, you know, you can take off your stuff. I'm like, shit, I'm cool. I'm like, all right. You don't got to tell me twice. This is before I was married to everybody.
Yeah. Okay.
This is before I was married the first time. You know what I'm saying? Uh-huh. But you don't got to tell me twice. Shit. Take off all my clothes. I'm chilling in the limo, butt-ass naked, you know. And then the limo driver, he had to stop and get something. I don't know. He pulled over. He was going to, like, I don't know whether he was going to, like, get gas or something. But I wasn't paying attention to where he was, like, what he was doing. And he pulled the car over, and he got out. And when he got out, all the lights in the car came on. And there were people outside. It was like, oh shit. Oh, so of course I had to, like, you know, people who could see inside the car.
Yeah. And you were in flagrante delecto.
Yeah. So it was a very funny moment that we both laughed at very much.
That is funny. I hope she reciprocated. You weren't naked by yourself.
At that moment, yes, I was.
Oh no.
At that moment, yes, I was. At that particular moment, I was.
Oh well.
Yeah, so
that's a good one.
Yeah.
I like that one.
I remember that was probably in
Get the year right.
Yeah. 2000.
Think about 2000. The wedding and then go back a couple years at least. Just
like
in case.
2000, 2001. Let's see. Drop the five.
Add the two, carry the three.
Track three.
Yep.
Yeah.
Cool. Thanks so much for doing this.
My pleasure. I'm glad it all worked out.
That's what she said.
It's time once again for South Bitch Sessions, where I rant about something that bothers me and I fix it. This week, fake Christmas trees. You guys can't be serious. A plastic tree with janky branches that can be bent and folded back into shape when it comes out of the bag that you zipped it up in last January and then shoved into the corner of your garage, and just unzipping it and putting it back in your living room is somehow bringing the magic and spirit of Christmas into your home? One day if I snap, it's probably going to be about this, because a fake tree? Why? Because it's less expensive and easier to set up and not as messy and doesn't need to be watered and doesn't need to be maintained? Lame. It's not Christmas unless I have a rash from putting the lights on the tree and my arm is covered in sap and I'm stepping on pine needles for months, well into the new year. And what about the smell A Christmas tree should make your whole home smell like a beautiful forest. Can't go buy a pine-scented spray at Bed Bath & Body Works and spray that shit around the room and act like we think your tree is real. A real tree has a beautiful shape, but isn't quite perfectly symmetrical. None of this bullshit where every single branch has an equal branch on the other side because you folded it into place. You should put it up, you should hang the ornaments, you should water it, you should notice how different it is from different trees from years past in fun and beautiful ways. That's the fun of it. Stop being so lazy. Go to a Christmas tree farm. Take a horse-drawn wagon out into a field, grab a saw, and cut down a damn real-ass tree for yourself. Have some respect for you. Have some respect for your family. Have some respect for trees. All right. I feel good about what we accomplished today. Fake trees are trash. You're better than that. There, I fixed it. Don't forget to go to the iTunes or podcast app, subscribe, rate, and review That's What She Said with Sarah Spain, 5 stars. Of course, thanks as always for lasting about an hour with me.
Well, that's what she said.